Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking Handmaid's Tale Season 4, Episode 1, entitled Pigs.
Perfect.
It was so good.
It was cathartic.
I loved it. And I love knowing that Elizabeth Moss has said we're getting a little more in the way of answers this season. Some of the promises that they have made, they're going to fulfill this season.
Yes.
And I'm really glad, and I'm excited with the way things are going.
I do. I really like it.
Yeah.
I do really like it. I especially like that I feel like the characters are getting even more dynamic at this point. And it's much harder to just categorize. And yet, in some ways, it's way easier to categorize. And so I love all of the tension.
Yes.
All of it. I am here for all of the tension. Mm-hmm. It's great.
So they left off at the end of season two with the escape of a single handmaid and a baby that didn't bring down the fall of Gilead. But the end of season three just might bring down the fall of Gilead because an entire plane load of children have escaped, but June is gravely wounded.
Yeah.
That's where they left us. And then COVID hit.
Oh.
And we had to wait
forever.
2 years before we could learn what happened.
Wait. Hold on. Like, I got goosebumps. Did we really just wait 2 years?
Yes.
2 years?
Because the season three ended in June or July of 2019. And it was supposed to come back sometime in the summer of 2020, and they had 3 episodes filmed. Well, I'll get to all that.
Oh my gosh. That's just crazy. As I digress, but yeah. I have to say this. I think COVID has changed time.
Yeah, I agree.
Because it doesn't feel the same anymore. Uh-huh. It feels quick and slow, really like all at the same time. And I feel like there's alien worlds out there who used to understand via relativity what our time was to them because they're just like smarter than us. And all of them are having to like recalculate everything they know because like Earth changed. It did actually though.
What?
It did because the axis moved a little bit.
Oh, well, yeah.
And it does that, but it's moved more than it has before. So actually, it did.
So time changed a little bit. More than we even realize.
Yeah, a little bit. I think it's a matter of
microseconds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like more than we've experienced before in our, you know, history of recording this. So maybe it's true. I don't know. I feel like alien worlds are like all back onto the calculus and doing all kinds of math. And I'm like, please send that to us. We need help.
Yeah.
Okay, I digress.
I get it. Okay. Let's talk about the new faces that we see. So there's Sam Yeager, who plays Mark Twelo, who has been in the show since season two, but we haven't seen him in an episode one before, so we haven't talked about him. And he was Joel Graham in Parenthood. That was his biggest role. I love Parenthood. It's just like a little family soap opera.
Oh, okay.
But it's one of the, it's a heartstring puller in the same vein as This Is Us.
Okay.
But not so manipulative.
No.
I felt like This Is Us got kind of manipulative.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like instead of just telling the story, they told the story in a way that was designed to really like just punch you in the gut.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And Parenthood was a little more organic.
Okay.
About all of the big unusual things that happen to the family. McKenna Grace plays Esther Keys. She was in the Full House reboot, which I did not watch because I don't care for Full House. Though if you do, I'm so happy for you. The Haunting of Hill House. She was the young Tanya in I, Tanya.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Uh-huh.
That's right.
Which I loved, I, Tanya.
Oh, did you really?
Oh, God.
Only saw bits and pieces. Oh,
it's interesting and funny, but dark and is great. I thought it was really good.
I was really impressed with McKenna.
Yes.
She nailed it. Like, I had to go look her up a little bit because I was like, who is this actress and where did she come from? Mm-hmm. She is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really good. Yes. Really good.
And then Bill McDonald plays Commander Keyes, and he's been a working actor since 1988, and mostly bit parts, but some reoccurring. His biggest reoccurring role, it was in something called Paradise Falls, which I hadn't heard of, but...
No, I don't know that one.
Sounds crimey, but doesn't have very many stars on IMDb, so I was like, ooh, maybe this would be interesting, and then I'm like...
Maybe it wouldn't.
Maybe not.
Wait till you're bored.
Yeah. All right, shall we recap it?
Yes. Oh, I dare you. I dare you to recap this.
Oh, I can do it. I've gotten good at it.
Yes, finally, you have.
I finally found my stride in the recap. Used to take me an hour to recap. Now I can do it in...
Yes, you have
three
really
to five
gotten,
minutes.
Yeah, you've gotten really good at it. But it's because so many things are important.
Uh-huh.
You know, but yeah, you do a good job. So hit it. I can't wait.
All right. So it picks right up where season three left off. We see June get some rudimentary medical treatment. And eventually they make it to, we'll get there, to a safe house. Commander Keyes and his disturbingly young wife, who is herself quite erratic. In Canada, we learned that it wasn't 52 children on the flight, but 86 children and 9 Marthas. The Waterfords are displeased that the children are not being returned to Gilead, but they seem quite pleased at the idea that June is going
on
to be captured.
Yeah.
While the idea of what they might do to June once she is captured seems to bring them no small amount of joy. So I think they call that Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
I'm not happy where I am, but I'm happy that you're not happy. So Aunt Lydia got a taste of her own torture medicine, and she was interviewed by the Eyes, who are ghoulish FBI agents, basically. Not for 2 weeks.
Not for 2 weeks.
For 19 days. She wants it known very clearly. She was... detained and interviewed,
air quotes and all,
for 19 days. Lydia condemns June while trying to uphold the idea of the handmaids. Now, is it to protect the women or her power? I think that's going to be a big question.
I think it is.
For the rest of the series. Friend or foe? Negotiating the volatile and unpredictable Mrs. Keyes is quite a challenge, and we learn the extent of the abuse that Mrs. Keyes has endured, and that the commander's memory is failing. He doesn't know anyone's name. All the Marthas are just Martha, and he doesn't even remember that his wife's name is Esther. Commander Lawrence... he's in prison.
Yay!
Ish. He's such a complicated character. His position is precarious, but not yet tortured. And it seems that what little power Nick has, he is leveraging to keep Commander Lawrence alive and maybe in power. He's betting on Commander Lawrence to be able to help and remain a powerful ally in the future.
Yeah, that's a complicated storyline. Mm-hmm. Talk about that tension.
Yes, for sure. Esther and the handmaids get a measure of revenge at the end, and June and Esther have a close but dark bond at the end of the episode.
It is dark.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, filming...
yeah, on pause because of COVID.
Yeah, Hollywood Reporter had an article in April talking about how it all went, that they had to make a lot of changes to the show. So they had filmed.
At least you didn't say tape it.
Oh. They had filmed the first three episodes and then everything got shut down by COVID. And the things that were supposed to be filmed later had to be changed because they couldn't have near as many extras and all different kinds of stuff. They had to try and tell the same story with a different basket of options is the way that Bruce Miller puts it. He's the showrunner.
Yeah, that is so hard because it's a piece where they can't incorporate masks. They can't incorporate COVID.
Right.
So they can't just keep going.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And so that is hard. Wow.
Well, and they had a whole, this article, The Handmaid's Tale Boss on Tragic Fates and Surprise Reveal in Season 4 Return. He talks about how literally people would come in and quarantine for 2 weeks in Canada, and they'd come and film for an hour, and then they'd get on a plane and go home.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
But the actors made the sacrifice because they believe in this.
Oh, wow.
So I thought that was really cool.
That is good.
Yep.
That's cool.
So the reviews are kind of mixed.
Really? Who is not liking this show right now?
Well, I pulled out the one that was the most critical. And the first line of it is something about how anxiety producing it is to even think about season 4. And I'm like, then why are you reviewing it?
Seriously.
It seems like you don't really want to be reviewing it. This is an assignment for you. So I didn't even put that one in here. I printed it out.
Seriously. And I was like, that's like a you problem, not a show problem.
Yeah. I absolutely
agree. Okay.
But IndieWire, Ben Travers, he's kind of wishy-washy. He says, here I am telling you to be patient, plow through the first 5 episodes and revel in the bounty waiting on the other side. Which I'm like,
what?
Are you kidding?
But there's so much happening.
I mean, I think it's great.
There's so much happening.
There's so much happening. There's maybe fewer horrible decisions being made.
Yeah.
Like by the protagonists, there are horrible decisions being made by antagonists, but yes, that's their job.
But I think, what is slow about it?
I don't think it's slow at all. He goes on to say, those who've stuck by it this long, you owe it to yourself to savor the payoffs waiting around the midway mark, as well as a handful of satisfying surprises. So I was like, okay, that's good.
I mean, I think I was personally taken aback watching Elizabeth Moss just nail it as far as expressing chronic pain and recovery pain and watching the little ways that she positions herself and uses her hand to push herself up and steady herself and make it try to look like it's natural.
Right.
For you to do that. But anybody who has ever done that knows exactly what's happening.
Uh-huh.
And those are moments that are like, oh, wow. Like, and she's talking about it. She's giving a narrative about how her body just doesn't do anymore. And it's just different. And oh my gosh, it just speaks to the soul. But whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's great. So I guess what I'm saying though is that I could see how somebody might feel like that's slow if you don't have an empathy for that pain.
That's fair. He goes on to finish up with, it delivers, season 4 delivers on delayed payoffs. Could they have done it sooner? Absolutely. Should they have done it sooner? Yes, but it's here now, and you know whether or not you need to see it. And I'm like, I disagree. I felt like so some of the pacing, maybe in mid season 2 and mid season 3, I can see where people felt like it was just being drawn out, but also some of those were passage of time, especially envelope episodes.
Yeah.
Like where June has to sit with her walking partner, who's basically been murdered, but is pregnant and they're trying to save the baby.
Right.
She has to sit there. That's this envelope episode there. It only does a small amount to move the story forward, but it shows you a passage of time as well. And it gives you more of an understanding of what it's like to be a handmaid in day-to-day life, how you're forced to do things you don't want to do, the sameness of it, the routine of it, how the monotony of it can really be detrimental to your psyche.
Yeah, it sort of seeks to normalize what is so abnormal about the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you're in it, the more you understand certain decisions that the handmaids or those in power would make because you have experienced the oddity of their underlying life assumptions and their worldview, which is where it's so hard for others on the outside to understand what's happening there. It feels like, why don't you just do this? And there's a thousand reasons. And those episodes are what clears all that up so they can move the story forward.
Right.
Because otherwise you sit there going, why don't you just do this?
Well, and it's a way to tell the story that's, there is monotony and boredom and frustration and all of the things that go along with that, but in a way that's not monotonous or boring or uninteresting. Yeah. I think people don't get it. I get it.
I know. And I want to understand that better, but okay. So last time we talked about Handmaid's Tale, I kind of went on the gender thing, right? Like yeah. I said, men, you know, versus women is kind of where I was like, I wonder if there's a big difference there. This time I want to ask the question, is there a big difference between those who tend to be book readers and those who tend to not? Because I think if you're a book reader who likes to get into that world and can immerse yourself enough that the language of the story becomes your language so that you don't ever have to ask the question, why don't they just do this from your point? Because you're in their world and therefore you sort of understand some of those nuances. Your critiques of their choices are within the construct of that world, not from outside that world. And so I think if you tend to like that, maybe the pacing of this show feels good.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe if you don't like that about books, if you're the one who gets really bored and lost with all the pages of description, this and whatever, maybe you don't like this show.
Maybe not. It's a thinker.
It's a thinker. So I don't know.
If you want something light and fluffy and not something that you have to think about.
Oh yeah, this is not it.
This is not the show for you. But if you want to like wrestle with it, I'm in a couple Handmaid's Tale groups on Facebook, and I love the discussion threads. Here's the discussion thread for, you know, episode whatever, two, three, whatever, so that you can go through and read them and have discussions with people who, so you're not doing spoilery things.
Right.
Like they know, okay, don't read this thread until you've seen episode two.
Yeah.
You know.
That's smart. Yeah.
I think if you're somebody who's inclined to want to go to a group like that and engage in those discussions, I think you're more of a book reader.
I feel like sound off, guys. Sound off, listeners.
Yeah.
Go in the comments here, because go on our social media, wherever it's posted, and start commenting and tell us whether you like it and if you're a book reader.
That's right.
Because I want to know, and we'll start, I'll get all nerdy. We'll do statistics and everything.
Ooh, sweet.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? I won't tell you until I know things, I promise, because that'll be boring for most people. But you have to comment. So go tell us, because I want to know. So tell us what gender you identify as, whether you are a book reader or not, and whether you like the show or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll start figuring this out.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to just be the Handmaid's Tale book. Are you a person who enjoys reading?
Yes, reading. Like, are you a book and not just nonfiction? Fiction. If you like fiction novels.
Right.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Sounds fun.
But Vulture did like it.
Okay.
Jen Chaney says, The Handmaid's Tale gets its mojo back. And I do feel like this season is moving a little more quickly. She says, it's challenging to explain what specifically makes the Hulu drama more compelling this season without walking into spoiler territory. But the key difference is that the stakes feel higher and more urgent. There are twists this season that will genuinely catch viewers by surprise, and some moments we've been waiting for since the beginning of The Handmaid's Tale finally arrive. This season brings some truly emotional rewards. Every storyline in season four of The Handmaid's Tale is a testament to the idea that some experiences leave such a deep imprint that they change a person forever. The past remains a companion, welcome or unwelcome, no matter where you travel. I was like, that's awesome. That's so good.
That nothing else to say. That's perfect.
All right. So we're going to talk about Is It True? Psychology Break and Real Life right after this quick break.
Scary stories aren't just for fiction novels. The most terrifying stories are the ones that actually happen. Nightmares brought to life. I woke up to a man standing with his hand over my mouth, and I bit his finger as hard to lure us deeper into the forest, tapping, on my window. Thing was scratching her up the door and drag her into the woods. If you're fascinated by the morbid and sinister things this world is capable of, tune in to the Nightmare Society podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix. New episodes every Thursday. Sweet dreams.
So here's how it works. Christy wrecks her search history. Hey, NSA, we promise it's nothing more nefarious than a podcast. To find out what's true, some of the psychological motivations behind the character's actions, and real-life applications that relate to our topic. I have no idea what Christy decided to look up. Could be the same thing that captured my curiosity or something I never thought of.
Is it true? So they mostly got the cauterizing thing right.
Oh, yes. Okay, please. Please talk about this because that was... Oh,
oh, oh. AdvancedTissue.com has a whole thing of information about it. And they said the most dire of situations is the only time you want to use this.
Okay.
Which
okay.
I think what they did qualified.
Oh, most definitely.
It was the most dire of situations. Find a painkiller. In the absence of a painkiller, something to bite on. Which is what they did.
They did.
They said heat the instrument. Now, this is what they got wrong. Heat the metal until it is hot, but not so hot that it glows red or white.
Okay.
And it did glow red. But I can see how in the heat of the moment, they're just like, we want it to be hot enough.
Yeah. And how do you know?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. They did it in, but we didn't really see it. It seemed like they just pushed it in and they were like, good, that's done, we're go. No, you want to do it in 1 or 2 second bursts.
Okay.
So that you're not blistering the area. You don't want to blister the area.
That would cause the very problem you're trying to avoid.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So basically, they should have heated it up till it was red and then waited. And when it turned black again, that's it.
Yeah. And then...
Hit it.
Yeah. But whatever. I can see there were helicopters and sirens and all kinds of stuff.
Whatever could have done.
Yeah, exactly.
At least they knew. At least they did it. At least they found a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
Right. Oh. And the only times you want to do this is when there's an extreme loss of blood. June totally qualified. And clotting agents are not available. So if you're outside of a hospital setting, really just try and go to a hospital.
Yeah. Yeah, don't just cauterize like. For fun. I don't know.
Well, or just because you want to save a trip to the ER.
Yeah.
You're worth the money. Go to the
ER. Just go.
You don't want to do that unless you're literally going to die.
And there's a bunch of other first aid things you can do if you're bleeding a lot, right?
Well,
like, you know, so I cut my thumb one time. We moved to Boston and we were there and we had gotten there at night, like move day, right?
Uh-huh.
We pull into town. Get into our new house. We know where nothing is. This is before phones.
Right.
We had no internet. Nothing, right?
Yeah.
The only thing we had seen was like a Walgreens somewhat close. I cut myself on something and it was bad.
Oh,
right?
No.
And so immediately I'm like, hand above heart. I'm holding my hand above the heart. I'm squeezing the bejesus out of it, you know, and holding it together for long enough, you know. And Ken's looking at me like, what are you doing? You know, like, but this is what you do, you know? And so he did. He took me to Walgreens and then I walked in the front door and my hand is above my head like this. The guy looks at me and goes, oh, first aid's over there. Thank you, sir. It was funny.
All right, then. So the idea that June could push through her pain and walk and move when she had to, also pretty accurate.
Pretty accurate.
I
saw it. She, I mean, that was just acting at its best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There was an article on ABC News. Injury, what injury? Fighting the Pain by Emily Friedman. Now it's kind of old. It's from like 2008, but I think a lot of the information is salient. So there was a Utah journalist named Ryan McGinney. He was filming a track and field event, and he went into a place to get a really good shot that he wasn't supposed to go. It was off limits to journalists. And what happened? He ended up with a javelin in his leg.
Ooh.
But because he had this rush of adrenaline, he didn't feel it. He took pictures of it. like right through his calf, all the way through, and he took pictures of it.
It's worse and worse.
He said it's not really painful.
Well, at that point, it severed all the nerves.
Well, it says that may not be totally true. Doctors familiar with traumatic injuries told ABC News that his body likely went into a physical reaction that blocked and drew his attention away from the pain rather than actually eliminating it. So,
oh, it's going to come back.
Oh, yeah.
And it won't take long, but in the meantime.
Right.
Yeah, all that communication is severed, right?
Right, yeah. Oh. Yeah. So it makes total sense that she could hold it together, and also makes total sense that once she realized she was in a safe place,
that she just collapsed.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think it's safe to say Gilead not so big on the human rights.
Understatement of the year.
Which is so interesting because they purport to be very, very concerned with the welfare of people, which is absolutely, I don't think, very true.
Well, no, that's how you cover it up.
Yeah.
As Shakespeare said at first, thou doth protest too much.
Uh-huh. Gilead's absolutely violating UN human rights treaties, Geneva Convention, the whole
across the board
caboodle.
Basically, they haven't even achieved acting well enough to be in a 3-year-old pre-K class.
Yes. On the UN human rights website, they had a thing. Torture only breeds more crime by fueling hatred and a desire for vengeance. It's really non-coercive interview methods are far superior than forced.
Yeah, actual torture.
By her view, Aunt Lydia's use of Delilah to describe June is accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Delilah is, according to Britannica.com and many interpretations of the Bible, a biblical figure who we all know the story of Samson and Delilah. Samson had his strength from his hair and she slept with him to learn this and learned that if she cut his hair, he would lose his strength, blah, blah, blah. And it has come to be synonymous with a quote unquote voluptuous and treacherous woman.
Yeah. A siren of sorts.
Yeah. Yes. Somebody who's willing to sacrifice their virtue for what might be considered the greater good or the greater detriment, depending on which side you're on.
Right.
Yeah. Depending on your view of Samson.
I thought that was a very interesting, I don't know, analogy that mm-hmm. Aunt Lydia brought up, because I was like, now I really don't know anything about her. I don't know what's going on in her head, but I know there's something. And that was very teasing because she's sitting there saying this about to try to almost to protect the other girls because she was like, they're not sinful. They've just been led astray. And then placed it all on June.
Right.
Why? And is she really, after being tortured for 19 days, is she really still on board with this structure? Does she really still think this is about family values? Like, hasn't June taught her anything? And you're like, I don't know. And it's just,
Okay. Here's something they didn't get right.
Okay.
Making penicillin.
Okay, yeah. They were like homemade, grown penicillin. Well, and I was like, that's interesting.
Okay, so you can make it at home.
Okay.
But it's more than just growing mold on fruit.
Yeah, scraping it off, she said.
Yeah, she like scrapes it off. It's a whole thing. Primalsurvivor.net, which is really like fun if you want to see what the whole prepper scene is up to. You just want to see like what's, going on, what they think is important. Even they say like, maybe penicillin's not where you need to spend your time. And here's why, because it's really hard. Hmm. It doesn't treat superbugs. It doesn't treat all infections. It requires some interesting and strange ingredients. It's not just mold on bread, though that's where you start. And they suggest to use homemade bread, not store-bought bread, because bread will have antifungal
Okay. Yeah, because it's
properties.
Not, yeah.
They like use preservatives and antifungal things so that it doesn't grow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that it'll last longer. But holy moly, it's a huge process. You do all the, you have to make your own petri dish. You have to culture it. You have to extract it and ferment it and then extract it again. And then after all this, for a reasonably large setup, you'll end up with about 100 milliliters of fermented homemade penicillin. Well, to treat strep throat, you need 125 to 150 milligrams every 6 to 8 hours for 10 days.
Yeah, so like...
Yeah, it's a... It's not a thing. They only suggest, like, doing this if this is going to be your, like, one thing that you're really good at, and you're going to make penicillin and trade it for all the other things that you need.
Wow. Okay.
He's like, if you don't already kind of have this equipment
on hand.
You're
not like a chemist.
Yeah, maybe do something else and trade for your penicillin.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Got it wrong.
But the Marigold and Comfrey Balm, much more attainable.
Oh, yeah.
Much more reasonable.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's, you know, you make an oil.
Salve.
Yeah. You make an oil infusion and then you thicken it with beeswax, basically.
Yeah.
And it actually would be helpful that people who made it on this is more 10thacrefarm.com, a little like crunchy.
Okay. Yeah.
So to speak. Yeah. Said, oh, yeah, I love having this. And it's, you know, in my medicine cabinet with my other
homeopathic kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Like
stuff.
Minor cuts and scrapes and things. I don't know if I'd suggest putting it on a bullet wound, but if it's all you have.
Woo. If it's all you have.
If it's all you have, maybe.
Maybe so. Interesting.
So Fred Waterford called the escaped Martha's apostates.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's a definition that I think is really up for interpretation. So Merriam-Webster defines apostasy as either the act of refusing to continue to follow, obey, or recognize a religious faith, or abandonment of a previous loyalty defection. I would say they're not apostates because they probably were never a part of the actual organization. They were slaves.
They were slaves. I can see why he thinks of her that way, because as far as he's concerned, they're not slaves. They're just a described part of their system. And in his mind, they are equals, but just happen to have different roles based on God's decision making. It's an extreme form of complementarianism. Right? Mm-hmm. So in his mind, she is going against God because this was God's will. Because remember, for them, it's a zero-sum game.
It is a zero-sum game. That's right.
There is, you are either with them 100% or against them 100%. There is not room for any disagreement.
Right.
So the fact that she has gotten on that plane and defected, right, which is also the definition. Mm-hmm. She has abandoned a previous loyalty. He sees that as a loyalty.
Right. Well, he assumed that they had a sense of loyalty at some point.
Right.
And I would say,
probably not.
Wrong, Waterford.
Wrong. Well, we see that in stories in our own country.
Yeah.
From the Civil War era.
Yeah.
Where there's stories of slaves holding down the fort for their masters' farm or household while the master was away, and they're fighting on behalf of their quote home and their master's home. And for that reason, people are like, see, they were part of the family. And you're like, there is a cognitive dissonance between fighting for the place that you are safe and your stability because you know you have to, and actually being loyal. That kind of loyalty is not the loyalty that Waterford wants it to be.
Right.
She was loyal because she had to be.
Right.
Which is, well, and oppression.
At the first available opportunity, she left.
Yes.
As did many slaves in the South.
Yes.
In the first available opportunity, they left.
Right. And we get so binary. We get zero-sum game about it, too.
Yeah.
Okay. For instance, there were many slaves who did love the children that they were taking care of.
Mm-hmm. does that mean that they were treated well? Or even if they were treated well, that they were treated respectfully? Absolutely not.
Well,
you
no.
can love people that are horrible to you. This is why abused children love their parents.
Right. And so it's totally natural for somebody who is a slave in that position, working in the home with the children, to love the children, to want better for them. Right. And then also to have a weird relationship with their owners, because they're not, it's so easy when you're oppressed to decide that because it's not worse, it's okay.
Yeah.
Ooh. That's what we do. I'm not being beaten or whipped.
Yeah.
So it's okay. No, it's not.
It's really not.
It's still not. Right. Like being treated, quote, respectfully or with love, or having people give you gifts while they're putting chains around you, is still not okay.
Yeah, it's still oppression.
It's still oppression.
It's less harmful oppression, but it's still oppression.
Mm-hmm. It's almost
bad.
More harmful psychologically.
Oh. Ooh.
I mean, yeah. Those who have been in abusive relationships will tell you, it just punch me. It's so much easier because it's just so much more black and white when you get, like, just beat.
Right.
Versus when you're manipulated, psychologically broke down.
Gosh.
That's horrible.
It is horrible.
I'm getting ahead of myself for this psychology break. Just, you know.
We'll get there in just one second. I only have one more thing in real life. So Mark tells Serena that she can't smoke in the prison conference room.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And she's like, what are you going to do? Charge me with smoking? I'm like, ooh, she's getting salty and sassy. Well, that checks out with Canada's current laws that really smoking is banned in indoor public spaces, public transit facilities, and workplaces by all territories and provinces in Canada. And they even go so far as to ban smoking in a closed vehicle with children in it.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, that's kind of awesome.
That
actually.
Is kind of awesome. I'm really all for that.
Yeah. All of the sources that we use to inform our discussion here on Killer Fun Podcast can be found on our social media. Join us on Facebook at Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or you can send us an email at killerfunpodcast@gmail.com, and I'd be happy to share a link to whatever information you're looking for. We love to hear from you. You might learn a little something too. Now psychology break.
Yes, because I was all apparently ready for it.
Uh-huh. So no one's all good or all bad. And this article from Vanity Fair, Laura Bradley has a really hard time with that when it comes to Aunt Lydia.
Ooh, I can understand.
The Handmaid's Tale has a serious villain problem. And there, what she really took umbrage with was that they humanized Aunt Lydia.
Mm.
You know, that she can have sweet moments with Janine or June or other handmaids where she seems very understanding and kind, and yet it's really fairly awful.
Yeah.
She says, at what point can we go ahead and write this character off as a bad person? And I would say never.
Never.
Unfortunately, because you just want her to be the villain. But this is a more complex story.
For all of those, unless they are the ones in absolute power.
Mm-hmm.
And even those people have a story about why they got there. But she is middle management.
Yeah.
She's both a victim and a perpetrator.
Yep. And she had the same issue with Serena Joy, also a victim and a perpetrator.
Right.
So I'm like, that doesn't quite square for me, but I can understand how we as humans, this is why we like the kind of entertainment that we do. We want a clear ending, which I get. I want that too in my entertainment.
Yeah.
I don't do well with unhappy endings.
Mm-hmm.
I want at least some sort of vindication at the end of my show.
I get that. Yeah, because it's hard to live in that tension and to not know. And as much as I advocate for the idea that people are not all good or all bad and I live in this tension, yada, yada, there is a big part of me I often fight that wants to go ahead and just average it and then decide on average which way do they lean so that I can say, oh, I've already weighed all the good and the bad. And then it came out on average bad.
Yeah.
And then I can just write them off because I've checkmarked my little tension by making an average. We do that in our real life too.
Yeah.
We take the actions of others around us. We sort of average them and we kind of say, not a person I want in my life and a person I want in my life. And we call this discernment. And it's not altogether bad or wrong.
No.
And yet we have to remember it's still kind of a flawed process.
Right.
We're still judging them from the outside. And every bit thing that we say, oh, well, this ended up bad, still has its own little story inside of it. And it's just, it's hard. But...
Well, and just so completely bad characters or completely good characters are boring.
Kind of, yeah.
Let's just remember that, too.
Yeah.
Elite Daily had an article, Is Aunt Lydia Good? The Handmaid's Tale Theory Could Change Everything. and basically, she's saying Aunt Lydia really thinks what she's doing is good. It's for the good of bringing children into the world and making sure they're cared for in the best possible environment. Is it a great environment? No, but it's the best possible environment they could have within Gilead. It's right. They have the most resources by being given to commanders when they're, you know, that the handmaids for whatever reason aren't appropriate for other positions. They can help humanity by doing that. It's difficult to see characters as good and bad because it depends on who you ask. So mm-hmm. If you ask Luke's ex-wife, June's awful. She stole Luke away from the rightful wife because she had a working uterus. That would make June very much a villain because they got together. He was still married.
He was still married. Yeah. And that was I struggled with that in the beginning.
Yeah. Which I can totally get. But yeah, so it's just a little more complicated than we want to admit.
It is, especially when you throw in the fact that she, Aunt Lydia, is oppressed also.
Yeah.
So just like with Serena, Aunt Lydia, again, is oppressed. And so that means her decision-making also isn't as grounded as it would be if she were free.
Right.
And she thinks she's free, and there's moments where she realizes that she's not, but then she sort of settles back into what she knows and what's comfortable because she has a degree of power where she is.
Right.
And so that's what makes it somewhat comfortable, right? I mean, look at it. She was able to stay up and correct the board, not 2 weeks, 19 days. That's because she is afforded a bit of privilege.
Right.
She is. And she took advantage of it.
She wasn't afforded enough privilege to not get interviewed.
Right. Exactly.
But she had enough to be able to say, it wasn't 14 days, it was 19. Let me tell you, I remember every hour of those 19 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was able to say that. And she was able to come back after an offhand comment and continue speaking.
That's also true.
Right? But she was very mindful. She acted this so well. Oh my gosh, she just nailed this.
And Dowd's amazing.
So she had this very measured way of speaking that is not her norm.
Yes.
Because she knew that there was an amount of privilege, but that it was limited. And she had to speak in a way, and she turned it around to say, capture her and bring her to me.
Uh-huh.
And that was telling them, I'm ready to take responsibility for it. But she also took advantage of her privilege to maybe twist the situation around to protect the girls that she thought might be innocent. Like, that is a lot of emotional and mind work. Like, nobody is going to be thinking logically if you're having to do that much work to survive.
No.
Oh my gosh.
No. Do you think maybe June has a little bit of a savior complex because she can't stay in bed because the girls need her?
Mm-hmm.
Like, she doesn't, it's kind of a double-edged sword because she doesn't give them the opportunity to help themselves, but she also knows them well enough to say they might not help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's interesting.
Yeah. Sarah Benton wrote an article called The Savior Complex for Psychology Today, Why Good Intentions May Have Negative Outcomes. People Skills, Decoded.com She uses that as a source to define savior complex, a psychological construct which makes a person feel the need to save other people. This person has a strong tendency to seek people who desperately need help and to assist them, often sacrificing their own needs for these people.
Okay.
So I'm not totally convinced that she has this savior complex, but I kind of think maybe she does because she puts a lot of pressure on herself. Mm-hmm. And we'll see that in episode 2 as well. There's a whole thing where she has to save some other people.
Mm-hmm. I don't think she started off with it, but maybe it's something that people who are thrust into a position of saving others and become leaders in those initiatives, mm-hmm. that they might start to feel that way.
Yeah. Ms. Benton goes on to say, while motives may or may not be pure, their actions are not helpful to all involved. The problem is that trying to save someone does not allow the other individual to take responsibility for his or her own actions and to develop internal motivation, which I'm like, okay, you know, we kind of see that. I hope Janine's off getting laid and enjoying her life. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that's not really helpful yet. So that's not where we are yet. And June can see that. And yes, they need that guidance. But I'm wondering if maybe she hadn't given them enough guidance before that for them to be able to say, okay, we still need to be really vigilant. This place feels safe. But just because it feels safe right now doesn't mean it's actually safe.
Yeah, I don't know that it falls squarely within the savior complex. I think maybe this is an issue of she was thrust into a place of leadership, mm-hmm. and she doesn't have margin. She doesn't have mentors.
Right.
And she doesn't have any history to help her be this person.
Yeah. She doesn't have any history with which to be the mentor to these other women.
No.
Like, she's just trying to keep everybody alive.
Right.
Like, which I get, but at the same time, she feels like she's the only thing standing between them and certain death. And she might be right.
She might be right.
But she's also not giving them any leeway to be partners.
That's true.
And she could really use some partners.
I guess that's why I think it's more of a leadership thing. You have to cast vision. Mm-hmm. When you're the leader, your first statement to people, they're not going to like it. Then this is what happens to them. Every time she says something, they give her a bunch of crap, right? Now, as a leader, you have to go in, you have to cast the vision, you have to be prepared for it. You got to not take it personally. You got to realize that they're just asking questions, yada, yada, yada. I don't necessarily think she enjoys being at this point part of the leadership of this. And every time she does step back, they crucify her when she's not doing enough to do what they think she ought to be doing. And then they crucify her because she's doing too much.
Right.
Because I don't know that they are really, they are Mayday.
Yeah.
But they're Mayday because they were oppressed and they're escaping to freedom, not because they are soldiers who went, this is us.
Right. That's fair.
And so I guess that's why I'm struggling with it being a savior complex, although I can see how it's starting to grow.
Yeah.
How it's starting to develop inside her as she, instead of investing that into the team and trying to build a team, but why, who's going to tell her that that's what you have to do? I mean, she's not ex-army.
Right.
She was a book editor.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, unless she happened to edit a book on warfare or leadership practices or building teams.
That said, she's had multiple opportunities to leave Gilead and has taken none of them.
Yes, but why?
Because she wants to save Hannah.
Yeah, she can't leave her. Not that she wants to save her. She says, I can't leave without her.
Okay.
Right? I don't know. Maybe there's a difference there.
I think... Yes. Maybe? And no.
No?
I think yes and no. I can see how much of her motivation is I can't leave Hannah. Mm-hmm. But also, I am uniquely qualified to help people. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's necessarily true. She can help people. Mm-hmm. I don't know that she's uniquely qualified to be able to help people.
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to sit with that.
Because we talked about this last time. It's not June's tale. It's The Handmaid's Tale. Right. She's not the only one fighting for all of this stuff. She might be the one that eventually gets there and makes it happen. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people have escaped across the border to Canada.
Oh, definitely.
This is something that happens all the time.
That's true.
So
that's the problem with the uniquely thing. I mean, that's not, I guess, just because she recognizes that she is in some way qualified and has opportunity to do something mm-hmm. doesn't make her self-absorbed or self-ambitious just because she recognizes an opportunity and says, for such a time as this, mm-hmm. I can do something.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it's less about realizing that she's uniquely qualified as than it is about realizing I'm in a unique situation. Mm-hmm. I'm in a unique position to do this thing. And if every time somebody stands up and says, I can do something here and I'm going to do it, we just call them selfish. I don't know.
I don't know that it's selfish.
Maybe that's my underlying assumption, because when I see savior complex, selfish.
I don't think she's selfish.
Yeah.
But I think she thinks she's uniquely qualified to be able to help this when she's had, as we mentioned,
no experience,
no training, not even editing a book on warfare.
Yeah. Like nothing. Like
that's what I mean. She's got the best of intentions.
Yeah.
But sometimes she's not as helpful as she thinks she is.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah.
And yet she has nothing to tell her that. She's just having to make decisions on the fly. How, you know, and sometimes, you know, she doesn't delegate a whole lot, but I get that because I struggle to delegate sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because I want it done a certain way. It's because I don't know what to tell you.
It's easier for me to just do it than explain to you how to do it.
I don't even know what to do.
Right.
I can't even get to there.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's not even about me wanting it done a certain way or don't want to take time to explain it. I literally don't know what the next step is sometimes. Oh. And so I'm like, I would love for you to help, but I literally don't know what I'm about to do. And so I literally can't tell you to go do it. Uh-huh. But if I happen to know something, I am more than willing to tell you what to do or how to do it for most things. Some things you really can't. But in my job with tech, sometimes it isn't worth the explanation because that would be...
Yeah. No. I'm on a time crunch.
Yeah. Like I can't explain to you how to do this thing because, you know, but a lot of times I find myself in a position where I'm really just going one task to the next and somebody says, oh, can I help you? And I literally at that point have no idea what's next.
Yeah.
So I know this because people are like, well, you just like to do it your way. And I'm like, really, I don't. Really, really. If I know what to do, I will tell you. But I literally can't even think about what's coming next. I have no idea. I'm not that good. I'm not that planned ahead. I'm just doing.
I barely got this fire point extinguished. What am I? I can't deal with that fire yet. It's not big enough to.
I haven't even seen this fire yet. Yeah. What am I doing now? Like I have a, I mean,
wait, literally. There's a fire over there?
What?
I don't know. Whatever you think you need to do with it.
Yes. That's my favorite person. I say this as somebody who leads teams. My favorite person who's coming and just says, I'm going to do this. And I'm like, great. That sounds awesome. Yay.
Excellent.
Don't ask me. Just come in and do.
Yeah. I didn't even know that needed to be done, but fine.
I'm so excited about it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I see that a little bit of myself in June with the way that she mm-hmm. doesn't delegate because she actually doesn't know what's coming next.
Why?
She can't tell them what to do because she doesn't know. And she doesn't know until the moment she does it.
Right. Well... fair.
Yeah.
Well, because she's constantly reacting to what they're doing in Gilead.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's not on the offense. It's always defense.
Always.
You can't tell somebody where to swing a tennis racket unless the ball's coming at you.
Yeah.
And if you're in that kind of job or position or whatever, that's when people tend to think that you are just a loner and you're kind of like, no, I'm just always having to react and I can't tell the future.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you where to go.
I'm not Madame Leora. I don't have a crystal ball.
So funny. Okay.
All right. Real life.
Real life.
So safe houses are vital for people escaping Gilead.
Yes.
And just as they were vital to slaves escaping the South mm-hmm. in U.S. history and during the Civil War and the years leading up to it. The Smithsonian had an article about how difficult it is to find the history of safe houses that were part of the Underground Railroad in the U.S. because they didn't keep good records. Because if you kept records, that meant if one of them was compromised, then they would know where they all were.
Oh my gosh, so, that's right.
So, like, they really, like, someone knew where the next one was.
Right.
But they didn't know where the last one was coming from. And they didn't know anything after the next step. And they didn't write anything down.
How did they develop this?
I mean, genius. Really? I mean, it's genius. But there was a black abolitionist named William Still. And his home was a stop for hundreds of people on the Underground Railroad in the United States. And the preservationists just in 2018 finally figured out where they think his home might have been.
Oh my gosh.
It took them that long to figure it out. The hardest problem of trying to retrieve the story of the Underground Railroad is finding documentation that the sites existed, according to historian Jim Duffin.
That's so amazing to think about.
And that they're still finding where these homes might have been located is just, it's baffling, and it speaks to the forethought that they had to be able to develop it and but not know where everything was. Very few people knew where everything was, and they didn't write it down.
That's amazing.
It's
mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing, but fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So Commander Lawrence asked Nick, Commander Blaine. I can't call him Commander Blaine.
I know. Nick.
So Commander Lawrence asked Commander Blaine about a trial.
Yeah, a trial.
And he's like, was there a trial? How did I do?
Commander Lawrence is funny, though.
He's really funny. He's like an awful human being, but he's really entertaining in a lot of ways.
Talk about not all good and not all bad. Mm-hmm. Like, ugh.
That's right. So he didn't get a jury trial, obviously.
Right, that doesn't exist.
But that's actually not really all that unusual. NOLO has an article talking about how that even in America, we have a criminal justice system, mm-hmm. and the idea is a jury of your peers and the whole, it's really only for serious offenses that you get a jury of your peers. There's, you know, bench trials where it's just the judge mm-hmm. and, you know, things where you plead out and all kinds of stuff. There's all different kinds of options, and really jury trials are only the most serious.
Yeah.
Because it disrupts a whole bunch of people's lives.
Yeah.
To have a jury trial. And there are a lot of democracies in the world that don't have jury trials at all. Most of Europe.
Wow.
Doesn't have jury trials. Somebody answered a question on Quora. Somebody basically asked, are there democracies which citizens don't have the right to a jury trial? And Pavel Adamek, who's a reporter in the Czech Republic, many EU countries have judges and the respective parties only. In Europe, the concept of peers is non-existent. Many people would sit on juries just to make sure that this guy who might have done it is thrown in jail just in case. In many European societies, the slightest suspicion is that the defendant might have done it. That would be a reason enough to convict, not the other way around. So it's really a mindset shift.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's people like that here, but that's why they go through the jury selection process.
Right.
Is to try to...
Right. Mm-hmm. South Africa abolished juries in 1969 because they felt like it wasn't fair. And one guy from the Netherlands said, here in the Netherlands, it seems odd that such difficult stuff is handled by people without the quote-unquote proper knowledge. Mm. So they would want... So it's interesting how some parts of Europe are going to say, we want to send them away just in case they did it because mm-hmm. we don't want somebody who did a bad thing to get away with it. And some of them are like, that is way too much responsibility, and I don't have nearly enough information about how the law works to make a decision on this.
Yeah.
So I'm like, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy that they all have the same sort of opinion about it, but not
For the same
reasons. For the same reasons.
That's very interesting.
Uh-huh.
That's something to think about. You do have the option to request a jury trial as a defendant.
It depends.
Depends on what the... Interesting.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of nuance in the law when it comes to that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, because I do know that with the plea bargains, there's just a lot that happens. And not all of it's fair.
No.
But, no. You know... You can't be perfect anyways. Yeah. And that's not an excuse to not be excellent. I'm just saying that, like, I'm sure that it varies per district, whether the process of the plea bargain and the back and forth and the bench, all of this is working its way out to something of justice or whether it's working its way to corruption.
Yeah. That's super fair.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, what Lawrence actually had, the closest thing that we have is a trial in absentia.
Okay.
Because he wasn't there. But really, the way he wasn't there, that he, like, didn't know it happened, but it did, not what trial in absentia really is, and at least not in the U.S. or really even in the U.K. So they're banned in some parts of the EU. Like, you cannot have a trial unless the defendant is mm-hmm. there. In the U.S., you can have a trial in absentia if you... Usually, you have to attend at least one day of the jury trial. You have to be there and then decline to appear after that.
So it's like the defendant's will.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it wouldn't... There was no will.
Now, how does it stack up against, like, the way we have trials for prisoners of war? Or people, because the way that Gilead works is if you go against them, you're basically, an apostate.
Yeah.
And you're captured and you're imprisoned.
Yeah.
And quote, interviewed. So it's almost like
everybody's a war criminal.
Yeah.
Everybody's a captor. Yeah.
It's kind of weird. I don't know.
Yeah.
Commander Lawrence. Yeah. How'd I do?
Thank you for your service.
It's so fun. That scene really cracked
that
me up.
That was really fun. See, and I can be like, I can appreciate the lines they give Nick. I still don't like Nick. So the actress who played Esther Keys.
Oh, she's amazing.
She's really 14.
No.
She was really 14 when they filmed this.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. Amazing, right?
I thought for sure she just looked young and that they did work and made her look younger.
No, no, no. She was actually 14. She said in an interview with Elle magazine, it means a lot that I got to actually play the age Mrs. Keyes is. I did think it was important for an actual 14-year-old to play the role, especially since this 14-year-old is being raped and abused and sold off. All of these things are happening to 14-year-olds every single day. If it makes people upset or uncomfortable that an actual 14-year-old is having to talk about how she was raped and it's acting, then maybe it will make you want to do something for actual girls who are going through this. I'm like, she's so mature.
Wow.
She's so mature.
That is a good statement.
It was so good, right? I'm like, aw.
That is a good statement.
She had, once she got the role, that's when she had wanted to watch The Handmaid's Tale
before. But wasn't allowed?
And her parents wouldn't let her until she got the role. And they're like, well, I guess you have to see it now to know how to play it.
Oh my gosh, that is such a good statement. And really, that principle should be applied to all kinds of things. If that makes you uncomfortable to see that an actress or an actor is playing that role, imagine the fact that it's happening for real.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yep.
Whoa.
Yep. So Esther is pretty unpredictable.
A little histrionic. Yeah, a little bit.
Which is actually sort of predictable for an abused child.
Yes.
The American Society for the Positive Care of Children had some interesting statistics. Abused children are 25% more likely to experience teen pregnancy, which was the goal for poor Esther, and are more likely to engage in risk-taking behaviors when it came to sexuality. About 30% of abused and neglected children will later abuse their own children, which is horrible and so sad. In at least one study, 80% of 21-year-olds who were abused as children met the criteria for at least one psychological disorder. The financial cost of child abuse and neglect in the United States is estimated at $585 billion. So I don't know over what time frame that is, but it's still a lot of money.
It's still a lot of money. It doesn't billions, matter.
Billions of dollars.
Even if it's a total, like a total since the beginning of our working on this, that's ridiculous.
That's a lot of money. And it, you know, if you have maltreatment and substance abuse in the house, that it's also very, very detrimental to kids. That if a parent abuses drugs or alcohol, they're much, much more likely to abuse their children, four times more likely. Two-thirds of people who are in treatment for drug abuse report having been abused or neglected as children. So it's a terrible cycle. If you can help break it, please do.
It is so terrible, and it's such a complex issue. It seems like it's not a complex issue, but it really is a complex issue. Mm-hmm. And, oh.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
Right. Exactly. So June and Esther are outside, and they're talking about if they would even see the drone.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, yeah. Oh, interesting. They, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't even see it. But you know what they didn't talk about? Was how you might hide from a drone.
Ooh.
So would you like to...
I like this.
Would you like to hear about how you might be able to hide from a drone?
Yes.
Okay. So wait for bad weather.
Okay.
That makes sense. So if you have to move... That makes sense
because they're using cameras.
They're using cameras and they're small and light. Mm-hmm. And so in really bad windy weather, they're less likely to be flying.
Mm-hmm.
Trees, walls, alcoves, tunnels... Those things are more reliable than weather.
Okay, yeah.
You know, because you're not having to wait for the opportune moment. You might not have that luxury. Mm-hmm. Like the ladies in this show, don't use wireless devices like GPS or mobile phones if you're trying to hide from a drone because they can see digital signatures sometimes. Okay. And you can do things to confuse a drone. You can put mirrors or broken glass on the ground.
Oh, interesting.
And so it reflects it. And if you're standing over it or you have elaborate headgear or like a blanket with a big pattern,
mm-hmm.
makes it harder for them to identify you as a human being.
Right.
You can kind of hide that way. If it's just, now, of course, you might not know this, but if you do know, happen to know what kind of technology someone is using and you're trying to avoid them, you might use mannequins, put mannequins out. Because if they're just looking at cameras, it might be difficult to tell the difference between a mannequin and a human.
Interesting.
So if you're walking through fields and you think they're over you, you stand still and it looks like a field full of people because it's all full of mannequins.
Yeah.
But they, or they know it's all mannequins, but they can't tell which ones are a human. But that won't work if they're reading heat signatures. But you can use a space blanket.
Right, okay.
Which are cheap on Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get really inexpensive ones. And that can really hide a lot of your heat. Or if you can go to an area where the heat would be similar to a body heat. So like if you're in a city, you might stand over a sidewalk exhaust vent blowing warm air, and that would temporarily hide your location. And then the most practical thing you can do to protect yourself is to get an umbrella.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
That it's really ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
It's the kind of thing everybody has. Anybody might have it. They're affordable. They're easy to carry. It doesn't make you conspicuous. You can put it up. And if they're looking down on you from above, which they usually are, they can't tell whether you're just a person who's trying to, you know, keep themselves out of the sun or if you're their target.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
Hopefully you'd have no occasion to hide from a drone.
Well, because I was thinking, like, what would I do, like, in the woods or in, like, open field kind of things, you know, for that? And it's like...
Space blanket would probably be
your... But if they're using cameras and it's... They may be able to see that reflection. Like, I don't know. Do they make space blankets that have, like, dog fur on them? So you could, like... crawl and look like a dog, you know? Like,
well, I would think you put a space blanket and then put another blanket over top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right?
Like, and then...
Like a animal pattern, like a... Not like... I mean, if you're in the swamp, don't put a tiger stripe on. But, like,
Yeah. Or like leaves.
Yeah.
You put a, you, I don't know, it depends on what you have available to you.
Right.
Zip ties, staplers,
who knows,
whatever you have to a blanket. Put your space blanket on, put that blanket over top. Yep. You look like a bush.
Yeah.
So next time we're going to watch The Flight Attendant on HBO. You said you wanted to see this.
And I did. I watched some of it already. Did you?
Okay. Yeah. It's fun. It's weird, but it's funny. And it's crimey, but
delightful also.
So it's a little more lighthearted
than The Handmaid's Tale.
It, despite the fact that there's a gruesome murder in it, it's a little more lighthearted.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.